here at school day.
Okay, folks, good morning and welcome again to Maynooth University. I'm Dr. Anne O'Brien. I work with the Department of Media Studies, which is based on the ground floor here. So this morning we have three speakers. We have Sarah Ann Dunn, who's with us from UCD, Judy Belger from Trinity College Dublin, and Marion, who's here from Maynooth University as well. So we'll give each speaker 20 minutes, and then we'll have a good bit of time, maybe half an hour, again for questions and debates and contributions. So if we start, Sarah, with you.
Thank you guys very much for coming and for having me. I really want to thank everybody who organised as well, especially Laura, who coerced me into doing this big time. She knows too much. But so today I'm going to be discussing, as per your own opinions, the wonderful or woeful character that is Agnes Brown and the representations of sex, sexual pleasure and marital rape, which appears throughout the BBC series specifically. In doing so, I'm going to kind of look at this through three lenses, mainly through a feminist lens, a revival of the medium of comedy in relation to these serious issues, and through an Irish historical lens also. Though in reality, this is just a passion piece that is an excuse to look at a lot of Mrs. Brown's clips. So just a really brief rundown of a very complex and lengthy series and legacy. Mrs. Brown kind of started as an RTE2 radio segment, a series of stage plays, it has a series of books, several film adaptions, and most famously it's been readapted into the BBC for live audience format that we all kind of know at the moment and either love or hate. It's also had multiple holiday specials at Christmas and New Year's and has been recently rebooted in a chat show format. Critically, Mrs. Brown is kind of like Marmite. You either love her or you hate her. So, and while she has been, the show has been lamented as the worst comedy ever and an embarrassment to the Irish nation, it continues to enjoy a very high viewership, especially the New Year's and Christmas episodes, which tend to get a very high viewership. John Fagan's 2015 article analysed the series and its popularity, and came to a number of conclusions as to why it's garnered something of a cult following, arguing that with its emphasis on profanity, drag, vulgar humour, physical clowning and sentimental family values, Mrs. Brown's Boys is a show that unashamedly taps into an end-of-peer comedy tradition and un-PC aesthetics. Fagan also crucially details the frank discussions of sex and sexual pleasure through the mouths of postmenopausal women as a key aspect of its popularity. We begin with Mrs. Brown and her witless sidekick, Winnie, reminiscing on their sexual heydays. So I won't show that whole clip because it goes on and it's amazing, but I won't show it all. And that is a condom on her hand, for the record. So as Fagan notes, this is a particular scene which places sex, bantering about sex, remembering it, looking for it, at the centre of the comedy, so far, so sitcom. And he's correct, this is atypical of countless sitcoms which rely on sexual banter and double entendre for their humour. But what's very significant about Mrs. Brown's Boys is the representation of an older generation of women speaking sex, reminiscing sex, missing sex. And therein positioning themselves not as de-sexed or post-sexed beings, as is often presumed of older postmenopausal women. Rather, they are women who continue to give voice to their desires, even if in their own safe space of Agnes's kitchen in this case. These are teams which frequently re-emerge throughout the series, often specifically between Winnie and Mrs. Brown, who enjoy a kind of open honesty with each other about their sexual experiences or lack thereof. And one of the most notable themes to emerge in their discussions is the kind of lamentation over an unfulfilled female sexual desire, an itch that wasn't scratched for them, if you will. And this is notably an historical issue in Ireland, with themes of repression and morality being expressed particularly in relation to women's sexual experiences and lack of physical pleasure. The trope of a sexually repressed Ireland is a recognisable one at this stage, occasionally stereotyped and often challenged, but it's something that a lot of us do relate back to Irish history in different ways. It remains a significant aspect of Irish sexual history, as has been noted by Irish historians and sociologists alike, with the Irish population specifically being described as troubled by sexuality, end quote, owing to contextually religious, political, familial and community-based ideology and discourses. And part of this trouble was the non-recognition of and ignorance around female sexual desire, indeed for many years owing to religious and political ideology, and as several theorists have argued, the intertwining of church and state, Irish women were considered chaste and virginal by nature and notably lacking in sexual desires or prowess. This has been noted in Paul Ryan's review of the most well-known Irish agony aunt, Angela McNamara. As a slight side note here to Mrs. Brown, McNamara's advice column was one of the most famous throughout the 1960s and 70s in Ireland, and she advised multiple Irish women and men in practical life advice, most notably around issues of sex and often around repressed sexual desires and fears of these desires specifically. As Ryan notes, these letters frequently reference the population's desire to improve their sex lives, often induced by a lack of sexual education or even honest discussion around sexual desire and pleasure that kind of continues in Irish culture to this day in many ways. As you can see, these issues often relate to women who felt men knew very little about their sexual pleasure and often outrightly failed to fulfil their sexual needs. Am I right, ladies? This brings us to our next clip from Season 2, Episode 2. I'm back in the room, sorry. Significantly, Agnes officially finishes this particular vignette with the comment, "Well, thank you, Reds or Brown, for leaving me with six orphans, not a single organism to show for it." And there's a lot that we can kind of depack here. At least I think there is. There's a lot that we can depack here. What I think is significant is not only that Winnie and Agnes speak of an unfulfilled or underfulfilled female sexual desire, where women's sexual needs are often secondary to their husbands. But moreover, these two women from the older Irish generation do not even know the correct terminology for said sexual desires when they reach their peak. The fact that Agnes and Winnie misterm orgasm as organism speaks to their own lack of knowledge around female sexual pleasure, while the scene itself suggests an unfulfilled sexual life. Agnes having never experienced orgasm at all, and Winnie only ever having had two, speaks to an ignorance of female biology and desire in many ways, and depicts a frequent failure to educate women on their own sexual pleasure and desires, and how this pleasure is often misplaced or underdeveloped in education systems and popular discourses around sex. Moreover, Fagan argues, this is a particularly transgressive scene in that, along with many other moments in the show, it specifically centre stages the sexual desire of the supposedly no longer desirable. Delving deep into its emotional roots and playing its vulgarity for maximum employment is fundamental to the show's appeal, end quote. So what's happening here evidently is, as Tom Inglis suggests, a movement towards new transgressive discussions of sexual desire and pleasure in and for women, which is specifically being discussed and displayed in popular cultural formats. As stated, what was once hidden, silenced and discouraged is now openly portrayed, discussed and encouraged, end quote. And evidently, a lot of these scenes are predicated upon a notably Irish context and history. As Professor of Sociology Tom Inglis has further suggested, Irish sexuality and repressive behaviours around sexuality were historically reinforced through political and religious ideation, which continues to affect the Irish state in many ways. Inglis does go on to argue that this is currently changing, potentially through pop culture and media formats becoming available for Irish consumption, suggesting that cultural transitions, quote, can be linked to a decline in the symbolic domination and moral monopoly of the Catholic Church, end quote. Inglis further argues one of the consequences of this process of change was increased competition in the representation and identity of women. The Catholic Church's teachings that women should be like Our Lady, virgins or chaste mothers had increasingly to compete with media and market images of sexually liberated and assertive women. And these are transitions which we specifically see in the next clip, where, without giving any spoilers, I just want to make a note of the fact that in this particular moment, two priests are present with Mrs. Brown. So she finally has her first orgasm. Hey, round of applause. So there's a specific attempt to challenge the old Catholic notion of women as unsexual, of the assertion of Irish Catholic women specifically as chaste and moral. Particularly as this scene, as I said, we have two presumably post-sexual, certainly post-menopausal women experiencing an intense orgasm in front of two male priests. And I'm going to just skip ahead on this a little bit. So what emerges here is evidence that Mrs. Brown is a character who often attempts to speak the unspeakable in different ways, as these cases show, as a way of speaking kind of postmenopausal sexuality and repressed unfulfilled desire. But further than this, Mrs. Brown is a character who gives voice to unspeakable trauma as well. In this particular case, I argue marital rape. So just to show another brief scene. So in this scene, despite the obvious overtures of comedy, and we are meant to laugh at this scene, obviously, Mrs. Brown gives voice to the unspeakability of rape. And though she does not literally name the event as rape, the accusation is there in the lines, "taken advantage of me whenever he liked," and she suggests that she had little to no interest in the events of, or in actually joining in with sex with Reds are at the time. Her only concern is keeping the place in the book. This mirrors the history of marital rape as a silent event, a non-event, an act which didn't or couldn't take place. As Judge Sir Matthew Hale stated in the 17th century, a husband cannot be guilty of a rape committed by himself upon his lawful wife, for by their mutual matrimonial consent and contract, the wife had given up herself and this kind onto her husband, which she cannot retract. This law lasted in Ireland essentially up until the 1990, when the exemption was removed from Ireland. And this meant up until this point in history, women had little or no say in their involvement in sexual acts. And indeed, this is an issue which remains largely silenced. Marital rape continues to be under-discussed, with only two men having been jailed for such events in Ireland since the exemption was removed. And I want to very quickly, really, really quickly, argue that what's evident in Mrs. Brown's discussion here is not just the unspeakability of the event, the lack of language to discuss it, but also the use of comedy and humour in the hopes of finally giving voice to it. In this way, Mrs. Brown reaffirms the use of humour as a tool for speaking trauma and abuse. Notably, this is a point raised by Dr. Jacqueline Garrick in relation to the treatment of Vietnam veterans. As she states, the use of humour appears to be a beneficial addition to the treatment of trauma survivors. Significantly, Garrick's work also reaffirms the use of humour to ease trauma, stating that if a client is smiling and joking while reporting a particularly painful childhood memory, it's likely that the client is not sure how close he or she wants to get to that memory and is attempting to obtain distance from the associated emotional pain. The use of humour in relation to rape and other traumatic events is often questionable and controversial. Rape jokes are perceived as immediately problematic, but I want to challenge this notion a little bit. While there are rape jokes which really do undermine victims' experiences and relieve perpetrators of their guilt and responsibility, there are also more nuanced jokes which challenge rape narratives and cultural structures which support these manifestations. This is a recurring issue that I've come across in my research, which looks at manifestations of rape culture online, that a lot of feminist responses utilise humour to challenge rape mentalities. In this regard, Vitas and Gilmore's research into unsolicited dick pics on social media recognises the use of comedy, which we might witness here in Mrs. Brown, to challenge patriarchal structures of rape as a restrictive structure. They state that subversive humour doesn't only provide an opportunity for the audience to witness poor hegemonic common sense, but challenges this common sense and reflects the absurdity of dominant ideology while undermining the very basis for its discourse. It is this subversive and transformative quality of humour that the ability to shine a light on hegemonic assumptions and render them absurd and ultimately laughable, which makes it a valuable tool for protest and subversion. Perhaps it's overreaching to relate Mrs. Brown to these renewed feminist discourses, but there's a clear attempt in the show to utilise humour to reaffirm frank discussions around sexuality, desire, and as Mrs. Brown herself would say, that's nice. Thank you.